wanted to be sure and mention is that I did have, it was a lot of work because I was in the classroom between lectures and labs 20-some hours a week, I'm sure. It was a full load, but I then would stay home in the evening. I'd come home maybe around 6 or so to be with the family, and I'd stay till the kids were in bed, which would be around 9, 9:30, and then I'd go back up to the office and stay there until, you know, 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock in the morning. Oh. I needed about, I could get by on about 5 hours sleep, 6 hours sleep, and then I'd do a little catching up on weekends maybe, but we always try to do at least one family day in the weekend. Usually Saturdays we try to go somewhere, just out in the woods or whatever time of year, do something. Maybe it's out in the snow or whatever. But it was a drag. It was a real drag. I remember going down the step, the front steps, it was in the winter, and it was like 9:30 at night. Kids were in bed. Arlene, you know, came out on the front porch here and was watching me, you know, saying goodbye. And she called me by phone. I managed to get them to arrange so that there was a line. In those days, we didn't have a lot of phone lines, but I managed to get them to put a line into Badgley Hall that I guess rang in the hallway or somewhere. I don't know. Anyways, a phone I could hear.
Mm-hmm.
So there was contact, because a lot of times there'd be no one else in the building. And so there was a way, though, for me to know that she wanted to talk to me. Mm-hmm. Didn't happen. It was more a comfort level for both of us than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, I started down those steps on the front here, and as you know, there's like 12 or 14, 15 steps there. And about the second step, I hit black ice, and both feet went straight out. I sat down, and I bumped down all of those steps on my rear end, with holding my briefcase in my left hand. Bounce, bounce, bounce. I think my right hand probably was guiding along the handrail that's out there. I didn't stop till I hit the bottom and slid out about 3 or 4 feet. That's one of my visions from the doctor, working on a doctor. But I did, and it was just grunt work. And I did write the dissertation. I had all my research done. I had all my data. I just had to analyze it. And I had to put it together in some kind of a reasonable fashion. And then we made several trips to Corvallis to talk to my major professor, because you got to do that periodically. And Arlene was doing all my typing. And while I was at Oregon State, we bought an IBM Selectric typewriter, and we could afford it by her working for other profs. So she was typing articles, professional articles for other professors. One prof that she got in with was a guy by the name of Bill Caldwell. And he was writing a lot of textbooks, and elementary chemistry kind of textbooks. And he was giving her a lot of typing because she had enough, she had a strong background in science. She's had, you know, organic chemistry, for example, in college, and general chem, all that stuff. So she's had a lot of chemistry, and she was also helping me a lot. So she wasn't, you know, the symbols and all that sort of thing didn't scare her. So. And he just couldn't find people that were comfortable with typing chemistry stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So she was typing for him about as much as she wanted, I suppose, at home. And so she was doing all my typing, and she did pay for that Selectric typewriter that mm-hmm. way, by doing the typing. And so she was typing my dissertation as it went along, and of course you have to retype it, and you can't make Xerox copies or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so several, and she'd go with me, we'd go to Corvallis every so often, and he'd go over my dissertation, and we'd review it and talk about where to improve it and this sort of thing. And I wanted to say something about, he was from China. He was educated in China up through his bachelor's degree, as I recall. Came over here and got his doctorate in the United States. But he knew English properly. He wouldn't let me get away with anything. And so I learned to write from a Chinese major professor. Now, I took some good writing classes. I had some good English instructor, writing instructor in college and in high school. But I didn't really learn to write until how to say it in a minimum number of words.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, and doing that dissertation with him, not aside from the scientific aspect of it, learning to write concisely with minimum words helped me a lot as an administrator later on at Eastern. Because I learned very quickly that when you write a memo, get it down on paper what you want to say, but then edit, edit, edit.
Mm-hmm.
And I could often find, I'd have in phrases, you know, but in the sense of and then you'd find out four of those words weren't needed. You know what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. And so I found that I could really write memos that were fairly concise, didn't take up a lot of room, and still got the message across. And he made me do that. Mm-hmm. And so my dissertation was like 45 pages total, including data and everything. Mm-hmm. But science dissertations are often that way. Mm-hmm. You know, a math dissertation sometimes is a bunch of funny-looking letters, you know, and not much else. But anyway, that's where I really felt like I learned to write. But anyway, completed it and took my oral in like in May and passed that. And during that year I was writing this, also Ralph was going to retire. I was 68, 69, and Ralph Bagley was going to retire June of 1969, and so they needed a new division head. And so they were carrying out a search for division head, and in those days you didn't necessarily advertise. So the president and the provost now, it would have been the dean of education then, Carlos Easley. So the president and Carlos Easley then did the search. Well, their search was interviewing, talking to all of the faculty in science and math, and finding out who they thought ought to be division head. And so they began to narrow it down that way, and then one day they call me over and say, Jerry, we've talked to everybody and we'd like you to be division head. And that's how I became division head in science and mathematics in June of 1969.
Can I ask you?
I never applied for the position, but I never applied for a job at Eastern University either.
It just came to you, huh?
I
have a question about the 60s, especially the late 60s in LeGrand and at Eastern. Did it have any of the flavors of the 60s, perhaps in other parts of the country? Did you notice any behavior by the students that was indicative of the 60s?
Not to the extent that you would read about in the paper or see on TV or something like this. We didn't. We had, there might be some students getting together and prating around about an issue of some sort or other, but it wasn't ever anything big. It really was pretty quiet here compared to other larger campuses, and especially in more populated areas, even like in the Willamette Valley, but maybe even a smaller campus. So the answer to that is, not that much. But one of the things that I saw, for example, and I'm sure you're aware of this, that it became out of favor to do a yearbook along about 1970. That's when the interest in the evensong activities that was really big in the 50s, well, they started it in the 40s and then it went through the 50s and into the 60s, it was fine. And in fact, I was the faculty chair of evensong for a few years after I got back in the late, I don't know whether it was around 1970. So I guess I was part of the demise of it. But anyway, there was just no interest in continuing that kind of activity and the yearbook activity and this sort of thing just went by the wayside. And that's the sort of thing that probably happened elsewhere too, but it happened here on the smaller campus. Whereas the...
So what would you call that? That the students just... didn't want to do activities that their parents or
The past
had done.
Wasn't as important as the future. That was, I think, looking to the future. I kind of understand it. You kind of hate to not have more recognition of the past, but it's kind of like when I was a kid, and I'm talking about now, like in my teens and before. I didn't ever have much interest in talking to my grandparents about the Oregon Trail in this case. I mean, here's three people that I remember that either were born here during the Oregon Trail time or one of them born here. The other two came across in covered wagons, and I never asked them a question about it that I recall. At least I don't remember anything from it. Mm-hmm. So I had no interest in it, apparently. And now, when you get up into your, 40, 50, 60, somewhere along there, suddenly it becomes interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Most people, I think, get into genealogy in their 60s, probably in 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And for no reason other than just interest, in my case. I think it's the same thing, you know, that lack of interest. And they decided, you know, I don't really want to know so much about the past or interest in the activities of the past. Traditions are not that important to me.
Mm-hmm.
It's the future that's important.
What about the 70s with the, quote, me generation coming through? Did you notice any change in the students at all?
Well, there was some, but you know, we get so, my opinion, we have so many students that are rural oriented. They might be from a, and live in a town, but you know, La Grande is still fairly rural in that sense. And so, and then a lot of them come from farms or from even smaller communities, that the ethic, the work ethic is still there, the ethic of helping each other is still there. And so they bring that to the campus. And so I never felt like we saw that much of it. Of course we saw some.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because students at Eastern don't want to be left out of the big world that's out there. And they, but you know, they're pretty knowledgeable on it with, between TV and, you know, and radio and publications and things. But they also grow up knowing that there's lots of things to do. And you, a lot of them you have to figure out and see that you do them yourself. I mean, you got to invent things to do yourself. But you don't have to have a nightclub to go to, let's say a teenage nightclub to have a good time.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to go to the movie theater every night to have a good time. Or you don't have to go hang out with the gang every night to have a good time. Now, I think it's probably moving away more and more from that. And you know, but in the 70s, I think kids came here just, you know, used to figuring out what to do to keep themselves interested. So, you know, they really were interested in the outdoors, you know, hunting and fishing and hiking and skiing and all those sorts of things. There was a myriad of things to keep themselves busy.
Mm-hmm.
And so they, you know, it wasn't so much of a me too, because you'd usually want to do it with somebody else and,
mm-hmm.
and things like this. And they were used to helping each other out, and they were used to living in areas where if somebody had a flat tire, you stopped and helped them change it.
Mm-hmm.
If they looked like they needed help. Or whatever.
Did your subject matter change a lot over the time, the late 60s, until you became the dean? Did teaching chemistry, because of the technology?
It changed a lot, both in terms of the technology, because of the kinds of equipment that was being developed, but also in terms of the subject matter itself. Students would come to us more and more sophisticated in mathematics and in the sciences. Now, I think you'd get some argument about mathematics from some people, but I always felt like they were constantly improving in terms of their math background. Always problems. I mean, you always got the kids that were woefully weak, and probably as weak when I retired in 1995 as when I started there in 1959. But you seemed to have they were keeping up too. The better kids were keeping up. The kids were working at it. But in science, the instrumentation was of course changing, and so the technology changed and this sort of thing. But also the subject matter itself. When I started teaching chemistry in 1959, we were teaching things that clearly are high school chemistry topics today.
Mm-hmm.
And you would expect today, you would expect them to come in. Especially the ones that were coming in to be science majors, they would probably be at the second year college level today.
Mm-hmm.
If you went back to 1959.
Mm-hmm.
So they're more sophisticated, but we were getting trained teachers out there. When I was in high school, I don't think the teachers I had in science, I don't think they probably had all that much science in college. They had some, I mean, they were science majors, but you might have a biology major teaching all of the chemistry or something like that too, and
mm-hmm.
you know, and they did as good as they could. They had some background, but not much. And in those days, high schools didn't require people to even have, if they were certified in one subject, they could teach the other subject.
Mm-hmm.
And they might be just teaching from the book, and they might be, sometimes they weren't even the day ahead of the kids.
So
chemistry's changed a lot.
Mm-hmm.
We've of course, my guy since there's been so much discovered. You know, you go back to when I was born, that's when the year the neutron was discovered.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the, mm-hmm. and the electron was discovered just a little over 100 years ago. And so we've gone, X-rays were discovered 1896, 108 years ago. When I was in high school, we didn't realize that anywhere, it didn't have anywhere near the understanding of the danger of radiation that we do today.
Mm-hmm.
And so you could buy on the open market radioactive capsules. You could order them out of a scientific supply catalog that today you'd have to have a license, a radiation license, in order to own them.
Was that in that chemistry set of yours?
No, it was. But I had radioactive, something was radioactive in there because it would have been a uranium oxide in the
set.
Yeah. And it should have never been in there.
Mm-hmm. Can you describe, I remember when I interviewed with you, you talked to me about a class called Science for Poets.
Yes.
Can you talk about that?
Well, a little bit. But Dave Gilbert's the one that taught that class.
Mm-hmm.
And he developed it. And it was after I became chairman of the Division of Science and Mathematics. But it was designed for anybody to come in and take the course just because they were interested in it. They didn't have to have a lot of math background. They had to have some algebra, but very basic algebra. Like if 2b equals c, what's, how do you express, what b is or something like this. Or if,
mm-hmm.
if 2a equals 5, what's a? That's the extent of it. You could teach it if they didn't know it. So that was the background, but the idea was that to generate an interest in science and an enthusiasm for science, because they discovered that there was a lot there in the science area for them to learn if they just would open up their minds to it and be receptive to it and not fight it. So Dave Gilbert had a particular way of doing that. It was really quite successful. And so he caused a lot of people to become interested in science that through that course. People are invariably non-science majors.
Mm-hmm.
One group that took it would have been the elementary teachers, too, that needed some science,
mm-hmm.
as well as taking a physical science survey course.
Mm-hmm.
But he would try to, it was more of a descriptor rather than being poetry.
Mm-hmm.
It was just a descriptor of, you don't have to be a scientist to take this course.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how he got it. It was a catchy way to get them into the class. And once they got in there, they'd get hooked.
How did you become dean?
Well, in 1980, there was some financial difficulties at East Northern University at that time, East Northern College, I guess. So there was budget issues, just like there is today. I've gone through at least three different major budget issues while I was an administrator from 1969 to 1995. And the one they've had the last few years, I can tell you that we did that in the 70s, say percentage-wise, just as tough. Because
mm-hmm.
I remember in 1973, around there, we lost, I think, 3 faculty out of 17. That's 15% of your faculty. I don't think they lost worse than that, 2 or 3 years ago when it was particularly difficult. So people forget. So it was just as tough then. And I'm not saying it was bad in my day. It's just that it's nothing. It is a cycle, and it probably always will be. So anyway, in 1980, there was another one of those kind of events. We'll just let the big 3 engine machine take over. I'm going to look and see who it was. Robert Oswald. I'll call him back. So in 1980, there was another one of those events. I don't remember the seriousness of it, but there was financial problems within the state, budget problems. And so it was an effort then to make the institution more efficient. And so by combining 4 divisions into 2 schools, then they would have the 2 of the division heads then became associate deans, but they also taught part-time or had other responsibilities. So if there was like a gain of 1 FTE administratively in doing it. And so the president at that time, Rodney Briggs, and at that time Dave Gilbert was his dean of instruction.
Mm-hmm.
And it hadn't yet been titled provost.
Mm-hmm.
It was still called dean of instruction, but anyway, it was the same job as now as the provost and vice president for academic affairs in 1980. But anyway, Rodney Briggs decided on this reorganization I really don't recall that it had how much it went through committees on campus. I just don't remember that. There would have been some discussion, because one of the things Rodney Briggs did when he came here in 1973 was to get the campus organized, and that's when we developed the college assembly concept. Mm-hmm. It's when we formalized the committees. It's when the faculty gained a lot more input into the committee activities. They had a chance to be on a lot more committees. It's when the curriculum committee, for example, became a campus-wide committee. And before that, it was sort of ex officio people were on it. Mm-hmm. And when I became division head, there were these committees I was expected to be a part of. And so lots of times you were surrounded by, not by so much by teaching faculty, as you were by other administrator types. Of course, a lot of us were also teaching at least half time. So as division head, I was teaching, well, almost full time at first, and then it went down. I had to decrease it because of the time issue. But anyway, in 1980, this reorganization was decided, and then they just asked me to be dean. I don't know who all they talked to, but I get called over one day and they say, "Jerry, would you like to be dean of Arts and Sciences?" And I said, "Well, give me a little time to think about it." And I thought, "Well, yeah, I guess I'd rather be dean than report to somebody else." Uh-huh. And so they said, "Okay, you know, they told me who's going to be in the school." And so it was everybody in the science division, and except they moved the science ed person and the math ed person into education, into the School of Education and Business. Mm-hmm. And I think those were the two they moved over there. And then they gave all of the humanities people were put in the division, or the School of Arts and Sciences, except the music ed person, I think. And they were put into the School of Education. And in the social sciences, because of the business area being in this other school, they put political science, and they put geography, and they put economics in the School of Business and of Education and Business. Mm-hmm. And I don't know the details of that. I was aware it was going on, but I really didn't have much to do with how that was divided up.
I heard Rodney Briggs was a kind of a character.
He was. Yeah, he and I had a lot of shouting matches. He was one of these people that he really involved his administrators in. He had a group of us that he involved in weekly meetings. And so the division heads, for example, at that time were all involved, as was the dean of education and the business manager and the registrar was in there too. But there was a group of us met in his office, and that's where you hassle out most of what happens, where all the decisions were made in terms of the campus. Except those that Rodney made. And he might have made his own after he talked to us, but that's where they were discussed. And they did. Everything got discussed at that level. Mm-hmm. And as time went by, he got the discussions more and more out into the faculty as these committees began to function. Mm-hmm. But the committees had a hard time learning to function. It's like in Iraq, you know, people don't know how to run a democracy. Eastern Oregon University was operated a lot like a public school system until Rodney Briggs came along. Hmm. And not that it was bad, but that was the structure. And Rempel, when Rempel came in 63, that's when some changes occurred. But the big changes came after Rodney came, and he gave a lot more power to the faculty. Faculty might not say that, but to me it was very clear. Mm-hmm. It was a lot. It was kind of how much would you accept, you know? Mm-hmm. If you're willing to participate and go to committee meetings and be involved, you know, you've got a lot more power. Mm-hmm. But anyway, Rodney kind of helped that happen. Mm-hmm. And then the institution, of course, has grown a lot since then. But mm-hmm. I remember Rodney Briggs, we'd just shake our fingers in each other's face. And that's probably a little hard to visualize me doing that, but I learned with Rodney that's how you did it. Mm-hmm. And he didn't mind it. I mean, that's how he worked. And he always left the science division alone, which created some problems for me because, you know, everybody else thought science division was getting, science math division was getting special attention. Well, we really weren't. It was just that I was fighting for everything and shaking my finger in his face. And not everybody perhaps wanted to do that sort of thing. And I don't blame them. Mm-hmm. I don't say that was the way you should do it. Mm-hmm. Some of them, I probably was willing to lower myself to his level, I guess.
What are some of the things...
Well, he reads that. He's gone.
What are the things that you're most proud of when you think back in your career of teaching and administration at Eastern?
Well, I don't want, this is not a priority kind of thing, okay, but one of the things that I have, that I'm proud of, is my involvement in the development of the extended degree program. I'm sure that's the right term, but you know what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And that I was in on that from the very ground level, worked with Dave Gilbert in writing the first general studies degree for extended programs. And Dave did the primary, he did the bulk of the writing. I want to give him credit for that. But he consulted with me, and so I felt like I had the input that I needed to make sure that it was written in a way that we could, that it was a quality program. And Dave and I were never in disagreement. I mean, we always agreed on this and was kind of helping each other. But he did the primary writing. But it was modeled on the general studies degree that we already had on campus. And so some of the things that we built into that were things like, how do we make sure that it maintains its quality? Because we knew there were extended degree programs all over the United States that you could buy for $15, mm-hmm. and there still are. Okay, so we wanted to make sure that it was quality. How do you do that? Well, the thing that I asked for to have was that all of the courses offered for college credit had to be taught by faculty that were approved by the appropriate faculty on campus, and the course was approved by the appropriate faculty on campus.
Mm-hmm.
There may not be a campus course like it, but there is faculty on the campus that can approve the course and approve the instructor. And to my knowledge, the extended programs has never offered a course for college credit that has not had those two levels of approval, mm-hmm. the faculty person and the course.
I think that's still true.
And you know, I'm convinced that that was critical to the quality of that program. And I don't think any other would disagree with it.
Mm-hmm.
But I felt that that was a role I had in that process. And I thought, you know, it isn't that I, and to be honest with you, there were some in the extended program area at that time, and they really weren't anybody that's been involved in the last 20 years or 25 years, but in the early days of it, there were some that thought that the extended program should have a lot more autonomy, mm-hmm. and a lot more responsibility for a lot of those decisions. And so I really fought hard for that. And I was at that time, my father was still chair of the, I was chair of the curriculum committee that helped.
Mm-hmm.
And the curriculum committee had a hard time under Rodney Briggs, had a hard time getting off the ground, and they went through a couple of people, and it just didn't do too well. And it's just a problem of faculty. You know, it's lots of times faculty just aren't good committee chairs, and they don't want to be. Mm-hmm. I mean, they like to be, but they haven't had the experience, mm-hmm. and they shouldn't have to be.
Mm-hmm.
It was wrong for them, and so the wrong people were asked to chair those committees in terms of calling people together,
mm-hmm.
And I would fault today some of the org. I think they've moved away too much. The curriculum committee on campus, for example, I would fault them for moving away from some of the academic administrators not being more involved in the curriculum committee. I just think it's a big mistake for the dean of arts and sciences and the dean of education and business not to be full-fledged voting members of the curriculum committee. That's just plain dumb.
Mm-hmm.
It really is.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, I don't understand it. You know, you're outvoted. So what do you want? You don't want to hear from them?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're the ones that have got the history.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to listen to them. You can outvote them, but you want the history.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you also want to get rid of the, you know, the inappropriate history.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, so I was curriculum committee chair, and I did that for, I don't know, 10 years. In fact, it got to the point where I kept telling them that I shouldn't do it any longer. I didn't tell them I wouldn't. I just said I shouldn't. And so finally they decided to relent, and somewhere in the around 1980. I probably started doing it around 76. And I suppose about 10 years later is when I got rid of that chairmanship. I did it for probably 15 years. The minutes would show how long. But I enjoyed it. It was a great experience, and it's where I learned how to work with all the disciplines,
mm-hmm.
how to work with all of the whole campus. And up until then, I hadn't had that opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
And being dean was, I look forward to that because it would give me a chance to work with others outside of science and math. Mm-hmm. It did give me some problems too, because science and math was used to having my attention and having my commitment and getting support, and I had learned how to work with Rodney Briggs in a way that I could get lots of things for science and math, you know, whether it was equipment money or whatever. I didn't ever feel it was unfair. I always thought it was fair. biased, yeah, but mm-hmm. I thought it was fair. But the thing is, when I became dean, I had to worry about how's theater being treated,
mm-hmm.
or how is music being treated, or how is psychology, you know, I was mm-hmm. selecting some disciplines. And lo and behold, there were these areas that had even greater needs than science did, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So science found that, you know, they weren't getting as much equipment money as they used to, percentage-wise.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had to work at trying to get the money totally increased so that science wouldn't be taken down in order to help some other area out and up, bring them up. But that was a real problem.
Mm-hmm.
But when we got Loso Hall, we had...
Must be something you're very proud of.
Yeah, I am. That would be another one. And I was allowed to be involved in that pretty extensively. They actually wouldn't let me after when we were constructing the building, though. They used to let me go over. I'd have to get a hard hat and I'd have to tell a certain person I was on the site. But they finally told me I couldn't go in without going through about three layers of approval because I was finding things wrong. I discovered, for example, that in the music area, that the insulation wasn't being put in some of the walls in the rooms. I'm the one that discovered, for example, that the balcony in the theater, the front rail was built, they measured from the back of it, and they should have measured from the front of it, so the seats mm-hmm. are all too close together.
Mm-hmm.
I'm the one that all was that I worked with Brett Timms, who was in the business office
mm-hmm.
and purchasing, I think. And he helped me, and he did the drawings, and I did the design work on all of those oak tables that are in the building.
Oh.
So I actually designed those tables. Now, I'm not a table designer, a furniture designer, right? I'm a chemist.
Mm-hmm.
But I designed those, and he'd go make a drawing, and I'd come back, bring it back, and I would redesign it, and then he'd go make another drawing. We got to the point where we put one out for construction to somebody that we knew was interested in bidding on it, but we could go ask them to build one for a certain amount of money. They knew they might not get the bid for the whole big batch, but they knew that it was going to be done. They'd get the bid on it at least. So we had this fellow build it locally, one table or two, and then we brought it back and redesigned it. And one of the problems we had was we had a brace down too low on the table and it was going to hit your knees and the students couldn't get underneath it.
Mm.
And when we designed it, we kind of thought, well, that's enough room, you know, it's in this far, but it isn't. They want to stretch mm-hmm. out. So we had to redesign a little bit, get the bracing up higher and that sort of thing. And they're made out of oak except for the top. Top was just formica.
Mm-hmm.
And formica glued to plywood. But they're all oak otherwise, and those mm-hmm. things are going to be there 200 years from now. Mm-hmm. They don't burn. Now they're heavy, but they're, you know, and so the faculty, though, got to decide, said, well, we can build them these sizes. You know, what size do you want in your classroom? You want them 18 inches deep or 24 inches deep or 36 inches deep? How long? So the faculty had some input on the dimensions, but he and I designed those. We put them out for bid, and we got them for about probably one-third of what the commercial cost would have been.
Mm.
And we saved tens of thousands of dollars on that. And that's how we were able to buy, some computers and some equipment. We were able to buy some equipment for the music area, and we were able to buy some things for, like, the shop equipment that was in theater and some things for art and those things.
That's really